Hi everyone, my name is Dr. Deb Roberts and I am the host for Season 2 of the Mind Medicine Australia's podcast. Before we begin with this week's guest, a reminder that Mind Medicine Australia's focus is on the development and the use of evidence-based psychedelic-assisted therapies within regulated healthcare systems. We do not, though, encourage the use of psychedelic medicines outside of this context, and we do not support the use of these substances in any way that is unlawful. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only. None of the content herein constitutes medical advice. Guests' views are their own and do not represent the views of Mind Medicine Australia, and individuals need to discuss their individual healthcare needs with their healthcare providers. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the Mind Medicine Australia podcast. I have Dr. Stephen Proud, and so I'm so proud already before we even start, because I know a little bit about your background, but welcome to this conversation.
Oh, thanks, Deb. It's great to be here. And I'm not linked to the Proud Boys in the United States, let me assure you.
Everyone can look do their own research on that.
Okay.
For both of us, as well as anyone listening that might not be in a motorized vehicle, I just would like to, and you can still do it with a motorized vehicle in your own way, but I just want to take about a minute. I usually uncross my legs and put my feet on the ground. I tend to sit cross-legged many places, but feet on the ground allows an opportunity for a balance of sorts, as well as a literal grounding. Mind space and headspace goes in lots of different directions. And so it's an ongoing practice for me to do that, but also the use of the breath. If you are able to, and Stephen, if you are inclined, I tend to close my eyes just for a few breaths, usually a reminder for the exhale, often to be kind of a focus so that we rid the kind of residue and almost the film or a visceral viscosity of sorts to clear a space for a rich conversation and that isn't as affected by the superfluous and mindless sometimes chatter and verbiage. So a couple breaths, if you haven't taken that already, also that the inhale will tend to take care of itself. And then just as you're ready, as you are inclined, just letting the eyes open. Sometimes we see things differently. I'm pausing for a moment, but Dr. Stephen Proud, I would love to begin, perhaps, if you're willing, at the beginning of your life, as we know it in this lifetime anyway. If you wouldn't mind, people who, your show notes will give the background and so forth, but perhaps if you'd like to just introduce yourself, and then maybe if you're happy to begin a little bit of the trajectory of your life so far that you would like to share for this conversation.
Thanks, Deb. I would like to share it because my life trajectory has informed me in many ways, and I still don't understand all of the ways, but it was quite important. So, look, currently I live in rural Western Australia with my two sons, my wife, my mother-in-law, and her aunt and uncle. So we're a multi-generational family. Ooh, and we've chosen to live in the country just to have more contact with nature and be away from a lot of the distractions, just to give the kids a chance to be connected with nature. I think that links to my own childhood, because my father used to work for the Bureau of Statistics and used to travel all around Western Australia sampling the population. So we didn't grow up in the country. We grew up in Perth, but when I grew up in the 50s in Perth, it was a rural town. It was not a big urban centre like it is now. So I've always had that connection to the country. I was the eldest of five boys. We were middle class. Dad worked hard, gave us a good education at a private school, which I loved. And my favourite subjects were mathematics and literature. And wow. I've not pursued mathematics, but I enjoy reading poems and plays. That's a big part of me. So school, I was good at school. I loved school. I was self-motivated. And I started to read about psychology when I was age 13. In the library, I'd get books out on Freud. I had probably no idea what they were about, but I'll come back to you in a little while that's relevant. So when I finished high school, I went to university in Perth, and then after my first year, which was just study, 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 I went to New Guinea and I lived on an island, a very remote island, for 3 months with a New Guinea family. So I would sleep in the hut with the family, be part of the culture. They asked me questions completely inappropriate for a 17-year-old, like how to fix up their relationships. And I've noticed, because I've lived in different parts of the world, that no matter what's going on, people's relationships, they can't seem to get them right, and it seems to bother everybody, whether you're an Australian, American, New Guinean, or African. So that was my first lesson, and my first experience with altered mental states was on that island in New Guinea, because they used to have betel nut ceremonies that would go for 3 days, a lot of chanting and dancing. And so I participated in that, and that was my first ever experience of a mind-altering substance. Before that, didn't drink alcohol. I was just focused on, a regular life, sports, study, and friends. Then the second year at university, which was in the early 70s, which is the equivalent of the 60s in California, please. Perth in the 70s was California in the 60s. And I experimented for 2 years with psychedelics, but it wasn't like taking a psychedelic and going to a party. For some reason, I was very interested in yoga, meditation, and all those things. So I tried to read a whole lot of books and use, it was LSD back then, although I had used some mescaline and psilocybin, just experimenting. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of years, I took time out of medicine because I was probably experimenting too much. And then I went to California for a year. And there I did a whole lot of alternative therapies, a la Esalen back in the 70s. And that's where I had my first introduction to Vipassana meditation. And thereafter, I gave away drugs completely. There was no drugs after that. It was putting all my efforts back into Vipassana and getting back into mainstream medicine when I came back to Perth. Mm-hmm. Now, Perth is a very mild version of California on the West Coast, and there was a psychologist who had been to India, mm-hmm, and had lived with Rajneesh, Osho. I don't know if people have heard of the Orange People. Mm-hmm. And so when I started to hang out with them, it was a complete opposite of what you do with Vipassana. Vipassana is fairly solitary. There's a lot of rules, morality. And the Rajneesh approach was kind of let it all hang out. Don't try and gild the lily. If you've got all this rubbish inside, let's expose it. And let's carry on like that. So that was my first lesson in how the mind can trick you, because I thought that I'd done a fair bit of Vipassana and I was quite a clever little chappy. You know, you could sit for 3 hours state and meditate, or 10 hours a day. But then this kind of rock and roll Rajneesh broke me open and I realized, gee, there's so much I still haven't dealt with. So I gave away medicine and went and lived, after I'd graduated, by the way, and I went to live in the Rajneesh commune in India, and I'd been going back and forward over the years. And then in the Rajneesh commune, and I try and learn with everything that I've been involved with. So it was fundamentally a really good experience, but I was very poor. I was living in a tent and then a bamboo hut, and I realized I was too young to give up medicine. And so I left the Rajneesh commune just before they left India and went to Oregon in the United States.
Yep.
And then I went to a rural Zululand in South Africa, and I worked in a mission hospital with the Zulus, and it was headed by an Australian doctor. And I am so grateful that I left the Rajneesh commune, because everyone I've spoken to, when it went to Oregon in the States, it got contaminated with violence, politics, guns. It was horrible. And looking back, I can see that there were a lot of politics in the commune. And a la George Orwell's Animal Farm, some disciples were not equal to other disciples, and there were power plays. And it's a very interesting thing. You can do a lot of meditation, you can do a lot of work, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're able to have the insight to confront inequality and power structures. And, you know, this is a learning, and I would carry this over to the psychedelic space as it's evolving today. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be good in it, but there will be power structures and egos. So that's part of the human condition. So I've learned two things so far in my short life. One, everyone's bad at relationships. And two, even if you're in the purest of spiritual pursuits, there's a whole nother dimension of power politics, which in some ways runs parallel to a spiritual pursuit.
Yeah.
So I'm in. Go on, Deb, ask me, or let's interact. How are you responding so far?
Isn't it true you're also a psychiatrist now?
Yeah, I'm a psychiatrist. I started off as a normal doctor. I was a GP for about 20 years in Africa, and I'll tell you a bit more, in rural Australia and Perth. And then I went back into psychiatry in my 40s. And that's when my father said, oh, you wanted to be a psychiatrist when you read Freud at age 13, and I'd completely forgotten about it. So there's the link.
You just said, how do you respond to when people communicate and talk, especially about their history, really. And there's so many things that struck a chord in the sense of, how different in some ways we start, and later on, you know, we think we're so different, but yet there's things that continue as our life history gets longer. And you use the phrase, I think, which was in India when you were there, but about being broken open. And it was, I just was really, affected by that, in the sense of, it made me think of this whole, you know, when we break open, sometimes we think also in mental health, you know, we break down. Breaking open, there's a lot of kind of a mixture of excitement, you know, fear, wonderment, and opportunity per se when we break open. And I just was really taken by a lot of things you said, but that notion that maybe we can connect on. Most listeners who have listened to this series, or if people are new to it, the reason why I wanted to have these conversations, one of the reasons is because my older sister ended her life November year ago, so a little over a year ago. The reality of our minds, the ways in which our minds, and you even said some things about playing tricks on us in some respects. The mind is this kind of literally this open field in a sense, but then also such intricacies in many respects, and then also simplicities. And I wonder, with that notion of being broken open, for people who are, you know, who you deal with this in your work, but in terms of people who are suffering, no matter what we might call that, or the, where on the spectrum people are in regards to that, how do you think breaking open is something for people to even seek? Did you seek being broken open? And I also, just with that, because as you said, you had gone to medical school, you know, for the most part, you had had some of that learning. You also, in the spiritual realm, you had already done, I think, Vipassana, et cetera. So you had kind of certainly more than tinkered with it all. Then we realize it's the tip of the iceberg. There's just so much more. And I don't know if you can maybe relate that to some of the work either you're doing, or how we can engage with being broken open.
Well, it's healing is a very delicate process. Yes. Some people have commendable enthusiasm and make themselves open, but you need discrimination, you need wisdom, you need patience. Some patients that I deal with, even though they want to get healed, I can see that they are too vulnerable and I have to slow them down. So hopefully they listen to me and don't interpret as me being a regular medical doctor and stopping them climbing the Mount Everest of self-discovery. But it's a delicate process. Sometimes scars are too deep and you can only ameliorate them, not cure them. Sometimes it's not the right time in life. But then again, sometimes it is the right time in life, and sometimes life will keep hitting you on the head until you actually look at what needs to be looked at. So for me, it's a delicate process, and I think a healer needs to have access to multiple paradigms, have a lot of experience and a lot of training, and actually work with each person where they're at. And that might include actually slowing them down. The old Zen story where the disciple comes with a question and the master says, go away, and they do that for 20 years until the question disappears. But that's in the spiritual realm, not so much in the healing realm. I should point out that I make no distinction between psychology, psychiatry, and spirituality. They're different names in the dictionary, but I've seen many people on a spiritual journey who should do psychological work, and many people on a psychology journey who should do spiritual work. So to me, they are just all part of the same process. And we'll come back to that question. I mean, when I was doing the psychedelics, I never had a breakdown except on one occasion when the dose was so, so strong that in an attempt to control it, that it was too strong, so you were swept away by the current, and so I jumped. Now, do people jump, or do people fight that current with everything they've got and then the current snaps them? I chose to jump, which was the wise thing. So my mind didn't snap. And then I had what would be called the equivalent of an 8-hour primal breakdown, but it was a breakthrough. And the people I were with were very sensitive and in tuned, and it affected them in an emotional way, deeply, in fact. And it has done me no harm. Now, I don't know whether it's done any good, and that brings a whole nother question of what happens in your life, what are actually the key things, what makes some of these changes and what not, because in the area of psychedelics, I think potentially they could do a lot of good, potentially for some people they could do harm, and I've seen people from the 70s who were casualties, and I see people now who are casualties. They have the desire to do it, but they probably don't find the right teacher. They haven't done enough preparatory work, and something goes wrong and they have a negative outcome. So again, it's a delicate balance with a lot of potential for good, but a lot of potential for harm. But now this is going to sound a bit funny. From a Buddhist perspective, if tomorrow I do a lot of meditation or I take a high dose of psilocybin and I have a transcendent experience and I see the universe, on one level, that's amazing. And you would think that that would have a profound influence on your life. And for many people, it did, a la the life of Baba Ram Das, who had this experience and then dropped it and went off and became a, what I would say, a compassionate and fairly wise person. But no matter what experience you have on the outside, the one thing that never changes is the witness, is the consciousness. So over time, you can have transcendent experiences, you can have very ordinary experiences, you can be happy, you can be low, things move, things change. There's the one constant is the witness. So spiritual greed, a hankering after those transcendent experiences, yeah, is in of itself an experience to be transcended. Yes. You know, it doesn't matter if you're in a grumpy mood. You're in a grumpy mood, you know, but we can talk about how to make your grumpy episodes less intense and less frequent. But in the end, things move. Don't have to grasp onto amazing experiences, you know. So I've had amazing experiences. Artie Lang had amazing experiences, Tim Leary. But if you read the books written about Artie Lang by his children, those amazing experiences didn't really make him a very good father. Yep. So I see that you're really listening to this, and I think you want to say something. I invite you to say something.
Oh, there's so much. It's just, you know, to be able to, I think, realize the grasping that we have as humans. I think it shows up in different ways. You know, I'm thinking, just because I'm doing some reading, and that in terms of addiction at the moment, that there's a grasping. We want something to, and I'm putting this very, you know, I'm watering it down, but in terms of to make us experience something different. So that grumpy mood, as an example, we can grasp at even the good things that make us, you know, less grumpy. And yet those grumpy sides, or maybe a more, you know, a darker time, or if you're going through a bout of a low, you know, you I'm trying not to use necessarily the clinical terms, but a low mood ongoing, or you could say depression, etc. I think about this, there's a grasping to want to get better, to, or yep, can be, or to just lessen the pain, which we then go into all kinds of rigmaroles, you could say, to to possibly have some of that pain at least be less lessened. But the interesting thing is, and I'm just wondering about what your thoughts are in this space related to the psychedelics or otherwise, because you have such a vast, you know, you have a lot of experience. So it's nice to draw. I want to ask about the Zulu and, you know, the Zulu experience in Africa and, you know, your international experience. But just in the basic nature of being human and the grasping that we do to not feel uncomfortable feelings, I wonder if that experience itself needs to be almost not flipped, but reoriented so that the lower, or when we are not very, when we have emotions that we find unpleasant, that somehow we reach a sense of, and I don't want to say wisdom, but experience, or the experience that, okay, this also will pass. Because you just said before, things change, and we do change. And I don't want to get too esoteric or ethereal necessarily through, I mean, we can, but in terms of, you know, even just the practicality of where we are in mental health in terms of the tools and resources, both in treatments, pharmaceutical or otherwise, and also all the different psychological frameworks that we use, et cetera, also with alternative health frameworks. And I know you've got a broad, you know, repertoire there, not simply the psychiatrist end. But what if our need to grasp, because it's human, that Buddhist concept, you know, life is suffering, you know, we have aversion, we have desires, that's human, but there's a way out.
Yeah.
Sorry, you know, and there's a way out of suffering. Not that we're not going to suffer, but that there is a way out. And I wondered, I don't know if you can weave what your thoughts are around the grasping aspect, but also in a practical way.
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts because I talk a lot.
Why? But, so we're a good, that's fine.
Firstly, to be sad and what not to be sad, that's completely normal. Yes. And, you know, firstly, my advice is, Be in relationship so that people are mirrors and they can pick up stuff about you that you can't pick up about yourself. Now, they will have their own biases and you will have your own biases, but fundamentally the other person acts sort of as a truth mirror so you don't deceive yourself. Now, if we can take a step back, when we use the word I, because I have evolved a sort of a meditation therapy spiritual thing based on my background, but at the same time as I've evolved this method, I am anti-method and I'm pro-method, so I'm both at the same time, and any method, no matter how good, is just a method, and the mind can always deceive itself, just as I deceived myself with Vipassana to being an amazing guy. And then I had a whole lot of crap that I wasn't even looking at. So if we come back to the I, you know, the I is the mind, the heart, and the body, and the witnessing consciousness. So the mind dominates. When you make a sentence, I am sad, firstly, if you can turn inwards a little bit and develop your ability to notice on the inside, it's actually much more complicated than that sentence. The sentence would be, the body is a bit tense, the heart has some sadness around it, the mind is racing around. Because the mind has done a Buddhist course, the mind is accepting the sadness, not accepting the sadness, wanting to stop thinking, knowing that it's impossible to think. In other words, it's a whole complex. It's never a simple sentence. So to escape, one has to see, feel the situation that you're in. Otherwise, if you don't appreciate the situation, any attempt to get out of that will only be a partial attempt, right?
You mean, is that also an acceptance aspect or not that necessarily?
Well, when you look at your own life, you will notice that at many times you accept and you don't accept at the same time. Yes. And sometimes there's more acceptance and sometimes less acceptance. And when you read a lot of psychology books, they talk about, oh, please accept, please forgive. Now, my question is, what is it actually that is accepting and forgiving? Is it the mind, the heart, the body? Because often they're fighting against each other. Yes. The mind is trying to forgive, it's trying to accept, but there's a little knot in the stomach. So why do we privilege the mind by accepting and ignore the stomach that says, no, I'm really annoyed, I want to snot you on the nose? So the mind wants to run the show and wants to push us in one direction, but the rest of our system is not there or is fighting in a different direction. So no big drama. I don't say accept or not accept. I just say check out what's going on and then communicate it to someone else, because if you try and keep this in your own head, you will editorialize it and prune it just to suit yourself, basically. And yourself is part of the problem. So I don't know, when I talk about it, I have this sense of humor. When a patient comes into my room, 90% of the time I am dealing with regular issues. I feel sad. I will give you an antidepressant that will change your chemistry and you will feel happy, and we can ignore the entire knot in you. But some people want to go deeper. Some people have tried antidepressants and the knot won't unravel. So then you give them a little bit more. You invite them to turn inwards a little bit. Or you say, oh, maybe it's that horrible marriage that you're in. Maybe you should look at that rather than an antidepressant. But again, that goes back to a healer looking at the whole picture and working out which little bit I need to operate in. So this grasping is very natural. And if you're an ardent Buddhist, you will train yourself not to grasp. But to me, that's the same trap of duality, because grasping and non-grasping, it means you're grasping at non-grasping, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So in the end, you're completely stuck. You're completely stuffed. But when you notice that you're completely stuffed, it moves. And the next moment, you're only 99% stuffed. It's quite a magical thing. And almost everyone has this ability. Like, you're smiling now, and the people who I talk to about this, they kind of get all confused in the mind, but there's a little bit in their heart that's quite excited. Yeah. And when we're sitting in front of each other, that little excitement grows. And even though there's a lot of fog and they can't quite see, they can see, oh, there's a little bit of light at the end of the passage. I can get out of this situation.
Well, you know, and I know you say that in some way in jest, in some way very, you know, serious as well, duality. You know, I am always coming back to as well for obvious reasons in terms of, you know, my own family's experience more recently. And, you know, I've said this before, but it was my father's father also, you know, ended his life. And so the kind of intergenerational influences or not, you know, again, just because you've had those two experiences, there's lots of other very healthy.
I really want to talk about that. So we have someone in a lot of pain.
Yes.
Wanting to end the pain, wanting to die. Now, first we have to look at the ecology, and the ecology is they are living in a family, they might have a partner, they might be working, and then they go to a therapist and they have 1 hour and they get charged and then they go back. So that's, we're working in a terrible ecology.
Yes.
One of the things in the Rajneesh was we changed the ecology. You're actually living in a community. And every second and every day is an invitation to feel, to communicate, to be. So I want to kill myself. I want to kill myself. Now, if we share that in the 1 hour of therapy, you then go back to an ecology, and that person in that 1 hour of looking at the issue is not strong enough, and the desire to die is going to win. So part of the problem is not just located in the individual. It's the whole ecology, isn't it, of healing. Yeah, you agree with that?
Yep. Absolutely. And I mean, one of the, you know, I think it's actually one of the things Mind Medicine Australia, you know, advocates specifically about is changing the ecosystem. And the ecology aspect is such a, an importance, just as much of an internal experience that someone might be having, how that effect is from that which is around them as well as inside them. And I guess that's what you're saying, you experience. But when the ecosystem or the ecology changes, do you differentiate there are better, what these are, you know, the aspects that will create that ecology in a different way?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, at a simple level, perhaps entering into psilocybin treatment and being engaged with people in preparation, the dosing and the follow-up, for a while you're out of your regular ecology into a new ecology, and you're given a powerful drug that can fast-track a transcendent view of your own situation. Yes. So there's immense possibility to get a better outcome in that situation if it's done well.
Yes.
And there are multiple other ecologies, you know.
Yes.
Leaving your family, going to a meditation retreat, going to a couples retreat, going to a women's retreat, multiple other, you know. I started a psychiatric hospital in rural Western Australia, where people could live for a month, and for the rest of the time, and these were people with drug problems, depression, lots of issues, because when you take away the surface, it's almost all the same underneath, no matter what the diagnosis is. So people could live for a month and go intensely into their issues without taking alcohol or watching TV at night.
Yep.
Other issues arise because when you put people together, which is fascinating and never comes up in regular therapy, all of the schooling issues, you know, who's in the in crowd, who's out, which girl is liked by the boys, which boy is the class clown, all the other dynamics come out in a community.
Yes.
So you have other issues to deal with, but it is a different ecology, and I'm in favour of those types of communities. Very hard to integrate in a modern commercial world where we're under the pump financially and just got so much. We don't have any time, but I think there are healthier ecosystems than the one that we have. Psilocybin can bypass it. Talking of ecosystems and going back to Zululand, I was there during apartheid, and you would think that with everything going on, the majority of the African population would have the most severe mental health problems. But because they still had a lot of their cultural traditions and because they were in the population majority and they were brought together in opposition to apartheid, that buffered a lot of the mental illness that you would have expected to see. So that sort of community support and allegiance was a protective factor. Just thought I'd throw that in, yeah.
Did you feel that yourself when you were in, you know, you've been in different communities, including the, you know, with Osho, the Indian community that went to Oregon, and then did you experience that yourself? I know you were obviously look different and were different, most likely in some respects, but you're a human with, you know, yeah. Did you feel a sense of, did you witness about them, or did you, was there something intrinsic in within you in that experience that you had? I wasn't sure what you did there specifically, but that you felt that community, that the ecology?
Yes. Well, I first worked in a mission hospital in the mountains. So I felt the community that I was living with, and I felt that I was serving the local community as well. So I felt, and I've always had that in me, wanting to give service and be part of a community.
As a doctor.
As a doctor.
You were there as a doctor.
Then I left the hospital and I worked with my a Zulu GP, and I lived illegally in the black townships.
Okay.
So because I was the only white person,
yes,
I felt an outsider, but because I had people that believed in me, I felt an insider at the same time. But I could observe, you know, the incredibly difficult circumstances of their life, but I could observe, and I felt not jealous. I really admired the way they hung on to their cultural traditions and the kind of quasi-solidarity, because when you're suffering, the solidarity fractures and people turn on each other, but there was still a solidarity, which I don't really see back in Australia, to be honest. I think people are living their own individual lives, less than I saw in dire circumstances, yeah. I mean, it might be different now. I haven't been back in many years.
Yes.
But this was back in the 1980s, yeah.
And, you know, I know you recently have been furthering your already expansive education, which hopefully just continues. But I know, you know, you've done some considerable study, even in the psychedelic space, not meaning your own personal experience that you've already talked about. But I wonder, in terms of, you know, in Australia, with the February legislation change and the potential increased ability for psychiatrists in the clinical space to be able to hopefully be able to provide people with the treatment-resistant depression or PTSD. And I wonder what your thoughts are after having done, I know you've done study in two different areas, two different groups related to this space. Now that you've done two different kind of courses, so to speak, in that specifically, what are your reflections? And also with the backdrop of your own life and experience, have you had time to reflect some of those learnings or insights or wisdoms based on what you are continuing to learn and apply, but also, you know, with your life experience?
Mm. Yes, so I did the Monash MDMA course and the Mind Medicine Australia CPAC course, and both of them were really valuable. And all the people that did the courses are wonderful people, you know, a lot of skills, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of compassion. So there's a lot of great people in this space. And the teachers, it's like at the CPAC course, the teachers were fantastic. The breathing exercises were wonderful. And in the MDMA course, the teachers were absolutely fabulous. All of the workshops that we did were fabulous. So I just see there's a lot of great people working in this area. We all know that it's going to evolve over time, and we're trying to walk that line between being safe, not too narrow, but not too loose, so we don't get casualties as I saw in the 70s. And then we want to make it available financially to a broader population, because the way it's been developed now, it's very costly, although there is a counter argument that if you've been depressed for 20 years, you know, it's money well worth spending. And if you've had PTSD your whole life, it's money well worth spending. So that's an argument. I understand that. As I'm in the country, I'm aware that country people tend to miss out on these sort of things. So I would like to try and establish something in the country, and I would get it up and I would be involved in it, and then I would hand it over to the younger generation, and hopefully, you know, like the hospital in the bush and the hospital in Perth that I created, it will be there, you know, for future generations. But yeah, there are challenges. I've been involved in an MDMA trial for a number of years now. I haven't actually done the therapy, but I've been helping in coordinated and set it up, and I'm aware of a lot of the things involved in a trial. So hopefully I can make an application and be authorized to prescribe MDMA, but I probably will need to run some clinical trials to get hands-on experience with psilocybin. And then when that occurs, try and set up a structure in rural Western Australia. And I would love to work with everybody else, because in all of the training, the one thing that is lacking is in the trainees being apprenticeships and actually using the medicine and reflecting on the use of the medicine. So I see that as the next step, integrating all of this theoretical training with a training centre where you can get hands-on practical apprenticeship training, and that would round it out.
Do you just mean for in terms of having that experience with the drugs yourself, or the apprenticeship to be the guide, or where do you stand
well, on probably both. I understand that there have been well persons trials where potential therapists have taken the medicine, because I believe, especially psilocybin, the experience can be way outside any experience you've ever had or any experience you can imagine. So yeah. I think in general terms, it's very useful to have that experience yourself. But in terms of being a therapist who delivers the psychedelic assisted therapy, or even the psychiatrist who authorizes it, I think the psychiatrist should have hands-on experience with the therapy as well, so they know everything that's going on from the inside out.
Yes.
So I could see an apprenticeship model where you have an experienced therapist that has had an opportunity to work with these substances and clients, take on a younger but skilled therapist, but who hasn't had an opportunity to work with clients when they are under the influence of these substances, and do that apprenticeship so you build up your experience. Yeah, I see that as being pretty important also to promote safety, because you can read about it in the books, but having the experience, you can't beat that.
And just going back to the beginning, did you say it was New Guinea?
Yeah, when I was 17, that's right.
You were 17 and you had the beetle
nut.
Beetle
it's
nut.
It's a mild stimulant.
Yeah. I keep thinking beetle leaf, beetle nut. And, you know, the, I guess, indigenous use of some of these, you know, they're not new in terms of, do you think that the use of, I mean, this is broad because psychedelics, you know, is a broad group, right? The fact that psilocybin and MDMA are the ones that have had the legalized change.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that is a good place that we've started in that regard in Australia in terms of the use of the drugs themselves versus other drugs that you might have been exposed to?
Yes, I do. I'm in favor of tight at the beginning and over time with experience, loosening it, but not making it completely open. I think, there are many arguments against what I'm saying. I can understand that, but I'm more on the cautious side. Yes. Look, I understand people's need to go off and do a sacred retreat with these medications, but, you know, beware. I've seen, as I've told you before, people with a lot of enthusiasm and good integrity go off, but they don't have enough understanding about themselves, and they can go off into an uncontrolled situation, and you don't know enough about the master of ceremonies and their skill level. And again, going back to my experience in Zululand in the 80s, I have worked with the traditional healers, and I've seen good traditional healers. I've seen manipulative traditional healers. I've seen evil traditional healers. I've seen the whole range. So buyer beware when you go off to some of these retreats. It's an unknown situation, and you're an unknown situation unless you've done a lot of work on yourself as well. Now, talking about the indigenous use, That has got a long established history, and it's part of the cultural heritage, and it's part of the transmission of cultural knowledge and values. Now, Westerners to some extent have been deculturated, so I understand that they are going off to try and get a cultural transcendent experience. And sometimes it may work, sometimes it goes wrong, but that was not the way in which these substances were used traditionally. They were used traditionally to, I suppose, promote the myths and the stories and the heritage of the group that used it. And a Westerner coming into that situation does not have that background. Now, traditional healers will morph to cater to the market, and I've seen that. And some of them may be great, and you might get a great experience, but as I've said, I've seen people that have been actually evil in Zululand, and others that are just very unskilled.
I'm just reflecting on everything that, we've talked about so far. You know, it goes back to, especially because of the whole different geographical regions you've been in, and some of the differences, but, you know, coming back to just being a human, which actually is the most, you know, it's an extraordinary system, so to speak, in terms of our systems that make us human and being alive, and the use of tools like breathing, because I teach meditation and yoga, I'm kind of more akin to those methods. But the use of the breath, what keeps us, or the heart and the systems keeping us alive, but the use of breathing, and you mentioned it with the CPAT course in terms of an experience of sorts with breathing. You know, the seeds of being human for any human, the potential for, like, as you said, when we're talking about kind of I'm thinking about the mental health system or the social systems and the political systems that contribute to how the ecosystem is or how the ecology is in a certain area. And I wonder, with these seeds, if we have seeds of potential as humans for violence, you know, in yoga, ahimsa is nonviolence, like one of the tenets in yoga. Yep. You know, I'm going back to the beginning with the mind. When we cannot trust the mind, I think, and in psychiatry, at least from a mental health point of view, the mind, and you said it, you know, the mind is a controlling essence, can be. And it's one part of us. You talked about the heart and the gut, you know, and, you know, the mind. You know, how do we, when we can't, in mental health at least, where, and we're all along a spectrum of, again, these emotions, like we were saying at the beginning, how do, you know, when one cannot or thinks that they can't trust the mind, our mind, I suppose from where I, from my experience, the whole somatic or embodied aspect is really hard. But you're talking about tuning into not just one area, you know, because your mind can be the dogma that we're telling ourselves. And I guess I wanted to circle back to this because as my, you know, my sister who ended her life, one of the, you know, she wanted so much. I have had similar experiences, not in terms of attempting to end my life, but in terms of mental health, you know, and depression and anxiety. And I've been in facilities before at periods of time. So when you were talking about your month long, you know, the ecosystem, you know, I've been in psychiatric hospitals that were more clinical, and I've been in, you know, in Byron, they've some private clinics that actually have a different ecosystem, which was better for me personally. And again, I realize that I'm talking about the eye here, but my, as an example, my sister as someone wanted to kind of go into that space of trying to, you know, have a different framework that she could operate in, physically, mentally, and emotionally. But she, you know, there's polypharmacy a lot in America. She, when she passed away, she was on 12 different medications. And I'm using this example because we know people, we know where there's so many different elements. And I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of, and I know you're a psychiatrist, but also in the different other realms that you operate in. And I know you talked about the words being, you know, psychiatry, psychology, and spirituality are words. And that you bring in a lot of different threads within your the framework that you offer a space, a safe space in, I'm sure. So when you can't trust the mind, or you think you can't trust the mind, you tend to go to, well, in the Western, you know, often you go to a doctor. And that's how our both my sister and I's experiences have been. But I wonder what your thoughts are for people that are like in the minds today as well that are not, you know, are not feeling well, but don't have this, they'd love to be spiritual. They'd love the mind to do different things. And I know it's so, you said it before, it's a delicate, there's just this, there's a delicate aspect to so much of how we can influence the mind. And then we talk about psychedelics, you know, being these, you know, bringing us perhaps out. And my, we were, I've talked about it before, but people, I mean, my sister, we were looking at that in the States for her to go to Oregon, but it hadn't been passed and et cetera, to look at doing that. But she had, you know, she had lost, you know, hope by that time, and it wasn't legal. So there's
that's a real problem. I mean, good people who are suffering reach out, and they might have 10 different opportunities to get healed. Yeah. And when it doesn't get right down to it, you get another problem called loss of hope. I've given it my best shot. What's the point? And so I will die. Yeah. I just want to say that at the moment I'm experiencing sadness, and as you're talking, that's what I'm experiencing, and a little bit of heat in my hands, and just a real appreciation of your honesty, you know, in sharing this. And I actually feel your sister here as we're talking, honestly, and sometimes with my patients, I see that this life is not going to work out. So very silently, I give them a blessing for their next life and their reincarnation. So I'm giving a blessing to your sister now. I feel it, you know. I feel her here as we're talking. And so I'm talking to her at this moment, and next life will be better. And I know this. I don't know how I know it, but I know it. So I'm just letting you know. All right. And this is what I mean about tuning in at the moment. My mind could have responded to so many things, but I had this energy in my stomach and my heart. And if I said, oh, we're in a podcast, therefore I can't bring my heart into the podcast. And this is what we do in our life the whole time, don't we? We divide ourselves up. We don't let ourselves be whole. Now, you still have to be politically savvy. If you're in Nazi Germany, don't bring your Jewishness into the conversation. But apart from that, let's all be here.
True.
You know, it's so hard because, again, the ecosystem, if your sister had walked into my room, now remember, I have a wife and children. I would feel like getting her in my arms, taking her into the retreat, and I wouldn't talk to her. I would just be there as a presence, and I would allow her in the silence to get more into her presence. And then, I mean, that might be weird for her, so I'd talk a little bit to give her some comfort and to sketch out the scape. And then over time, energies would come up. Now, even that makes me sad that I don't do that for all my patients, but I have a family and children. And my oldest son said that I spent too much time looking after people and I wasn't around enough for him. So I'm not doing that again. But that's another sadness, isn't it? When someone reaches out and you can feel it. 100% can't be given. And it's a sort of one of the realities of this life, a painful reality. Yeah.
And when you say the painful reality, you know, in what you just said is actually, I was talking to a friend the other day there. I have a challenge with the word tender, being tender, which, you know, could have lots of discussions on that. But the reason I bring it up for this podcast and talking that there is, you know, as you were describing, quite a beautiful way of holding space for someone suffering and in pain. You know, the alarm bells also go out, and you know this, you know, I'm sure, in terms of safety of people. Yeah. And so I've just met you, you know, but I know a little bit of your background and so forth. And, you know, you just said it's a hard reality, you said, or it's just a painful reality of how also that wouldn't be appropriate, you know, as a construct. And yet as you just said, even going back to your different experiences in your life of where there were people who were not, they weren't holding space in a way that was safe.
Yes, yes.
You know, I wonder, I don't know if you feel comfortable communicating about that. Like, it's so hard, right? Of how do we, how do we shift the ecology and yet know that as humans, you know, we have violence in us. We have aspects that can, for some people, have eventuated in some of these ecosystems that have been more, communing. I don't know what your thought, what are your feelings and thoughts around that?
Well, going back to your sister, you know, as a psychiatrist, first thing I would have to do is engage the family and assess the level of risk.
Yes.
And would have to give her an antidepressant and get her set up with a psychologist and get rid of any drugs and alcohol. And then if she was at serious risk, she would have to go into hospital to make sure that she lives to fight another day.
You did that.
Yeah, we do all of that, but still the black cloud persists and it goes down and down and down. So we need to think laterally. Yeah. Okay, we've given it our best shot with our standard treatments.
Yeah.
Where do we go next? Do we have that little thread that we can work with your sister?
Yeah.
And every now and then go back into safety mode, then come back to that little thread. And that's what therapists are doing all the time, maintaining that thread, trying to build it, make it stronger. And using all of your skill and all of your training and paying attention to all of the facts. But your sister or patients also have to meet us.
Yes.
There has to be a little bit in them that says, yeah, I'm going for the light. You know, and I'm particularly struggle with males who come to me and say, I've completely opened up, and yet I know that there's like a 5% they never, ever, ever, ever open up on. And that's that 5% that will kill them. And they never, ever let anyone into that.
Well, and on that point, Stephen, I don't want to lose that because, you know, some of the, let's say conjecture, some of the thoughts around, not thoughts, some of the evidence in terms of people who have had these experiences with psychedelics, the idea is that somehow, and the people, I haven't had it myself because I haven't had that experience, but, you know, where that 5% isn't ever communicated, that the experience with the psychedelic kind of somehow goes to that and somehow explores it in a way that in many cases unexplainable, but somehow healing can then, you know, perhaps, you know, begin. I know that's a positive outcome. But what?
Absolutely.
But how,
I agree with that.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think that should be part of our treatment armamentarium. And you pick up, we're not going anywhere. We're trying our best, but there's a little dark spot in the middle. So we said, oh, well, let's go and do MDMA for trauma or psilocybin for depression, because something from the beyond is going to come in. You know, we've given it our best shot, but we need some sort of backdoor entry, some sort of transcendent entry, something that brings in a completely new paradigm. And that can help many people when nothing else works. And there's even an argument, instead of waiting for the 2 or 3 years and losing hope, of bringing it in earlier. Yeah, I agree. This is one of the wonderful opportunities with these psychedelic drugs. And look, even if you're not at the extreme end who are going to die, you know, there's a lot of people that only get a partial recovery anyway and are kind of living as though they've got one lame leg. They're not dying, but they're only quasi-living. Yes. That's also another group that might want to experiment with this, or be treated with this, rather. Yeah, so I'm in favour of that.
And I think that the, you know, so many, I know with that example specifically, there were times where, you know, one of my teachers in India, you know, that my sister had a, you know, a consultation with, and that they were going to work together, you know, and for a little bit. And, you know, the interesting, you know, so there were even kind of weeks before we, you know, she passed away. There was exploratory on lots of levels, but the at the time, the psychedelics the legalized aspects in America weren't available. But the other aspect, which is what I was saying at the beginning of me looking at addiction, you know, benzodiazepines, there was a long history of long-acting benzos, and that's a whole nother, you know, subject of people with addictions, how to penetrate the underlying problems.
So. Yeah, well, yeah, I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and you know, I fundamentally agree with Gabor Mate that underneath every addiction there's feelings they haven't dealt with and trauma. But when you use a substance repeatedly, you'd get a second problem, and that's the substance and the habit. So, you know, if your sister had extreme anxiety and started to medicate that from a young age, it means she's got a long history of not dealing with emotions.
Yeah.
And so to rip away that Band-Aid, you know, is not easy. It's going to take many years to learn to go into a feeling. I mean, this is what we should be teaching our children, how to feel feelings and just say, oh, feeling's a feeling. You know, and let's not make a big deal about feelings, but a feeling is a feeling. But we, many people are trained to avoid feelings, aren't they?
And
including me.
And avoid though feeling, uncomfortable feelings, which is, we talked about this before. I know that our time is going to, you know, I could be talking to you all day. I wondered in terms of perhaps, I mean, you have shared some of your hopes and ideas in terms of based on experience. Is there from your, you know, your experience in health, healing, and I guess even community, are there some other kind of big picture or specific practicality things that are coming to your mind, or that even before we started the conversation that hey, she's not asking this, and I really wanted to share this because it's we know that there's threads, and we talked about this at the beginning, you know, threads that our conversation can go, which is lovely and wonderful. And thank you so much for
I'm going to be naughty before we wrap it up, and I'm going to do a typical Dr. Proud thing.
Okay.
And I'm going to follow my intuition before we come back and wrap up the session.
Okay.
The word guilt is arising in the present moment. So the word guilt is floating in the air as you and I have been talking. So a friend of mine, I won't go into details, but who's lost all of his siblings to drug addiction. And when I was a medical student, the first one died. So I was very young, and a family member said that I was not just me, but me and my friend, we were responsible for her death because as medical students, we didn't do enough. And my mother died just before she was 70 from stomach cancer. It had been an ulcer, but no one had ever put the pipe down into her stomach. And I felt guilty that as a doctor, I didn't force her to go to the GP to have the pipe when it was just a small thing in her stomach. And I've got to say, when I hear you talking and psilocybin wasn't available, those of us that are left behind often carry a lot of guilt about what if, did I do enough? So I just had to say that was coming up in this space. I wanted to talk about my guilt, and to anyone who's listening, who is carrying guilt, all right? Let's let it float. Now, let it come up and float into the cosmos.
Before you then change from that, can I ask, is guilt useful?
Yes. Guilt's really useful. You just don't wallow. You just get on with it and learn from it and be a better person, be a more skilled person. When it turns to wallowing, bad. But when it turns to
recognition of the feeling you actually aired it. And do you think airing it facilitates it, the ability to go, or do you think it feeds it?
No, airing it, if you air it in the right way, and this is another trick. So I have a DVD. It's called My Guilt. When I put it into my machine and press play, it plays My Guilt. But does my guilt go? No, because it's still in the DVD. So I need a way to play that DVD, and as it plays, it erases. And that's another discussion, but there are methods where energies can come out of your system so that you don't just relive the trauma, relive the issue. You experience the issue again in the present moment, and it starts to flow and disappear and not come back. So there's a distinction between repetitive replaying and replaying and erasing, okay? So there's a science and art to that.
Thank you for adding that. I appreciate it. And I think anyone listening, so many different, I come from a Jewish background, you know,
a lot of guilt.
Jewish guilt. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of hand movements, guilt, and enmeshment where we're all in each other's stories. No, wonderful aspects of coming from a Jewish background, and also some of those things that we can air float and let go.
I feel very connected to Jewish people, but they're bloody terrible to do psychotherapy with, especially when they're so clever in their minds. Bloody hell.
Yeah. Touché. Yes, that's it. Great. Okay. So thank you for addressing that. I don't know if anything also, as I said, just prior to coming on, or that you felt for listeners, you know, people listening to this, obviously there's trigger warning that we always say in terms of talking. I mean, we talk about end of life in every conversation. So, you know, but people who are listening and can still listening to this at the end of this session, this episode, you know, you do have a lot of experience. I acknowledge the fact that I know you're still learning, and that's wonderful. But is there any other kind of topics that you feel or to touch on that you would like listeners to reflect on or be conscious of?
No, I actually am really excited to be talking with you, and I hope that everyone that listens to this maintains their excitement, but translates excitement into action, and just do an audit on yourself. And if you think there's a little more work or a little more skill that you need to obtain, don't have a fear of missing out. Everything will come in its right time. Just go and do the work on yourself and get the skills and buddy up with the right people. Good luck with self-exploration, yeah? And self-exploration is fun. And do it with people who will give you honest feedback about yourself, who you trust.
Yeah, I think you said that around the witnessing, not our own witnessing, but also people around us who we do come in contact with that are our own mirrors in some respects, but also who will be trusted people that we actually need to listen to. There's not that many people we have to listen to in that respect, in terms of who is passing the reflection back, but it is, I guess I also feel for people who, you know, do feel, I often say this, I have, you know, I have been blessed in many ways in my life through family and friends and et cetera. And yet I do feel very lonely a lot of the time myself. And it's kind of more of humans feel a sense of loneliness in a way that is, not necessarily existential, because you really feel it. You can be around a bit, you know, you can be around a lot of people and still have a sense of feeling alone. But it goes back to what we said at the beginning. It's a, like, loneliness is a, I feel like it's a human.
Well, aloneness is a human condition, not loneliness. My last word from Dr. Steve, who could talk forever, and I love talking with you, Deb, is, what is a conversation? A conversation doesn't start with the person who utters the first word. The conversation starts with the person who, in their silence, generates an intense listening and an invitation. And then the words that are spoken by someone around you were actually the words that need to be spoken, and you've given an invitation to. So
that's lovely.
Everyone, practice that. The new art of conversation.
New art of that's your next book.
Yeah, that's my next book.
Thank you, Stephen. Right. It's been a real pleasure. People who would like to get in touch with you, we'll give some of the show notes, of course, but is the best way to connect? I know you've got a website. Is that the easiest?
My email, I think Mind Medicine Australia's got my email. So probably, I've got a website linked to my psychiatric clinic. They can get, but my email, that's the way, yeah. Okay. Like Barack Obama responded to every email. I'll try and do the same.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. This is, it's a continued conversation.
Thank you so much, Deb, for the invitation to talk. Love it so much. Thank you. All
right. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Mind Medicine Australia podcast. As a listener, you are very important to us. If inclined, we would love for you to follow the show, which just means wherever you listen to your podcasts, press the button follow, and that way you will be updated with each and every published episode. Lastly, if inclined, we would love for you to leave us a 5-star review. That way it's letting us know that we are meeting the needs of everyone who is listening. Thank you very much.